Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks. Luli, great to see you again.
And you, Felicity. Now, before we get into today's episode, which I am really super excited about, as you know, you've recently been in Wine Paris, which is the big annual wine and spirits trade show in Paris. Yeah, well, clearly it's in Paris. It's in the title. Anyway, this year they had over 50,000 visitors over 3 days. So what are the key trends that you saw coming out of that?
Okay, this isn't quite what you asked, but I'll answer the question I want you to ask, which is the most important thing is that Wine Paris has now established itself as the big wine trade show destination. A couple of years ago, it was very, very French, and all of the non-French producers were kind of an afterthought. But now it's obviously a very international show. And of course, it's in Paris, which is unbeatable.
Yes. Now, that's what I've been hearing from a lot of people. So what was the mood like amongst the wine producers specifically?
Really, really good. For all the doom and gloom we're hearing, I heard a lot of stories about people doing really well. I went over to the South African stand and they were chipper. Some people over there were reporting increased sales of up to 40% last year.
Yeah, okay, good news.
Okay, so let's change from wine to beer. I was reading a report this morning that said that beer sales are kind of tanking. But I have to be frank, and I have to admit I know zero about beer. But even with my lack of awareness, I've been hearing about Guinness from all over the place. And I know you're very excited about this topic.
I am, Felicity, and mainly because I've just had a lot of fun doing the research for this episode. Yes, I take my commitment to this podcast very seriously. So for this episode, I signed up to taking the WSET Beer Level 1 course, and I also went to Dublin for 2 days.
Oh, of course you did it just for the podcast. Thank you so much, Luli. Yeah,
you're very welcome.
But I guess you weren't just gallivanting about in Ireland. Did you pass your WSET Beer Level 1 course?
Okay, so yes, I did. So the course is really brilliant, actually, and I'd really highly recommend it, along with the spirits and wine courses, obviously, that WSET also do. And if you haven't done one of the level one courses and want a great and actually really quite detailed intro to these drinks categories, then I'd really strongly recommend it.
Okay, so how dedicated do you have to be? How long was the course?
Okay, so full disclosure, as you know, Felicity, I'm a trustee of the WSET, so I'm a super fan of the courses worldwide. But the level course one I did in beer was over 1 day, and then we had the exam at the end of the course. And actually, I got really nervous for the exam. It is multiple choice, but the amount of detail that's covered in the course, it's quite a lot. And there's quite a lot of technical detail about brewing and processes and categories of beers and flavour profiles.
Did they give you beer? Did you have to taste beer?
Yeah.
You were still nervous.
Fair enough. No, I don't know. I won't even talk about the swallowing and spitting bit. But yes.
Did you pass? That's the big question.
Yes. So I did. And when I got my results, so I'm not sure if I should admit this because it shows how stupidly competitive I am. But I worked out that if there were 30 questions, which there were, how many did I get wrong to get the pass mark that I did?
So tell us, how many did you get wrong?
Okay, so I got 2 wrong out of 30, which still slightly annoys me a bit. So let's move on.
Well, no. I don't know whether this says you shouldn't have tasted the beer, but then, of course, you wouldn't have got through the exam. Or well done for taking the time to go to the brewery, because if you hadn't, you might have got 3 questions wrong.
Okay, so
speaking of Dublin, that city is, of course, the home of Guinness, which is the drink that I'm hearing about all the time now.
Yeah, that's right. And not only has Guinness been dominating headlines for the past few years, but my lovely niece Ella asked me a question about Guinness that I thought the listeners might also be interested in listening to themselves.
Now, Ella is already a friend of the show because she has in the past already asked good questions. Okay, so what was her question about Guinness and how did it come up?
So I was chatting with Ella. So just for context, she's 30 and her sister, so my other niece, Holly, who's 28. So in our chat, Ella said, in the last 2 years, Guinness has gone from something that in my eyes, old men like my dad drink, to my go-to pub order. Why has this happened? So I'm just going to add a disclaimer to my lovely brother, Ella's dad, that she is the one that called him an old man, not me.
Oh, old man, my generation. Let's move along.
Okay, so when we were chatting, Holly also backed this up because she said she's only started drinking Guinness in the last 18 months or so, and now it's definitely her go-to beer of choice, especially in the winter. Holly also mentioned that she drinks Guinness 00 and does what she called staggering. So throughout the evening, you know, one full strength, one zero strength to moderate her overall alcohol intake.
Yeah, so I guess that's the zebra striping behaviour we were talking about in a recent episode on moderation, where people alternate between full strength and no alcohol options on the same night out.
Correct.
Okay, so before we get into the current situation with Guinness, I need you to tell me what Guinness is. I know it's a beer and I know it's Irish and I know there's an amazing and iconic advertising campaign that's been done in the past and that's all I know about it. So the floor is yours.
Okay, so have you actually drunk Guinness, Felicity?
No, I never have.
Okay, so we have another piece of podcast homework for you.
We do.
I will be checking in on our next episode. So let's get technical. So Guinness is a stout. So stout is basically a dark beer. And it's dark due to the roasting or the dark roasting of the malted barley that's used in the brewing process. So Irish stout is known to be smooth with pronounced coffee and chocolate flavours as compared to, say, for example, the traditional English milk stouts, which had lactose from milk added to them to give them that sweeter, more creamy flavour.
Do you know, I think something's coming back to me. I think I read somewhere that milk stouts used to be sold to women who just had babies because they claimed that it increased milk production.
Yeah, well, maybe. That's a good thing that maybe the milk stouts aren't so popular anymore and but they could make a comeback potentially, but maybe just not with that claim.
Okay, so we know that the iconic dark dry stout is back and it's back in a much bigger way.
Yeah, well, I think I've become really kind of hyper Guinness aware since that conversation with Ella and Holly. So I've mentioned to a few people over the past few weeks that we're recording this episode on Guinness. And I've been amazed by the fact that everybody I've spoken to has a view on Guinness or indeed has their own Guinness story to share. So, for example, my personal trainer, he said that Guinness was absolutely his go-to drink of choice year round, although he did mention that many of his friends will switch out of Guinness, particularly in the summer. He also mentioned that his wife, who has recently given birth to their baby, her first alcoholic beverage post-birth was actually Guinness.
We won't ask about milk production.
No. Let's not go there. I don't think she's drinking it for that reason.
No, she's definitely not. We're not defaming her.
Flavour, definitely.
Flavour.
So I was also speaking to Jane Thompson. She's the founder of Australian Women in Wine. And when I mentioned Guinness to her, she told me that she lives up in a rural location in northern New South Wales, so up towards the Queensland border. Anyway, she said that in her local pub, which she said is a very much a kind of country setting pub, last year the pub stopped serving Guinness. And she said there was outrage amongst the local population to the point that the pub now does serve Guinness again. And Jane did mention to me, though, that what a pain it is when you're standing behind somebody at the bar and the guy in front of you decides he's going to order 8 pints of Guinness just at that time when you're trying to get your order in.
Well, I will never not be proud of my country. When we do something, we go big. And I am frankly surprised he limited himself to just 8. Now, as it happens, I have some stats right here next to my hand. Mm-hmm. YouGov has said that Guinness is the fourth most, quote, improved brand in Australia, which I guess is a euphemism for higher sales.
Yeah, sort of. Yes, it correlates. But actually, in that YouGov survey, what they're talking about more is the brand reputation opposed to the kind of absolute volume of brand sales.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay, well, you know, guess what the other most improved brands are? Amazon, WhatsApp and TikTok.
Okay, so there's a reflection on our digital world. So back to Guinness, and I am seeing Guinness everywhere. So I was in our local pub in South London a few days ago, and of the 9 tables that I could see from where I was sitting, I would say at least over 60% of the people on those tables had pints of Guinness in front of them, and in some cases, Guinness was the only drink being consumed.
What do you mean out of the 9 tables? Did you go around counting the tables?
Well, yes, I did get up and down a few times to make sure I could fully observe what was being consumed on each table. Now, Felicity, you know, I'm a researcher after all. Let's call that ethnographic observational research.
Yeah, so 5.4 of those tables were drinking Guinness. 60% were drinking Guinness.
Okay, so you've done the calculations. So maybe my estimates are slightly wrong there. Anyway, do you think I might slightly spook people out a little bit with my kind of behaviour of observing what's
me.
Going
You're
on?
Me. Okay, so back to my fact sheets here. So Guinness has grown in terms of the volume of Guinness grown globally. Now, in theory, Guinness is a heritage brand because it was created in the 18th century at the Arthur Guinness Brewery in Dublin. So I looked it up, and here's a 1982 article I found from the New York Times. Quote, "The origins of this brew go back to 1759 when Arthur Guinness bought a small brewery at St. James Gate on the south bank of the Liffey and signed a 9,000-year lease with city officials."
Blimey. I don't think you get 9,000-year lease today.
Yeah, talk about a commercial advantage. Mm. Okay, so at first he produced several light and dark beers, but 40 unexceptional years later, Mr. Guinness decided to concentrate exclusively on porter, a dark beer with a rich head. So like many brands with historic roots, it trades off this heritage, but it actually belongs today to Diageo, which is a multinational that also owns brands like Johnnie Walker, Tanqueray, Baileys, Smirnoff, Don Julio. However, Mr. Guinness's legacy is still going strong. According to CEO Deborah Crew, Guinness emerged as a standout performer for Diageo in 2024. Organic sales had grown by 15% and more people were drinking it in Great Britain, Ireland and the US.
Yes, and Guinness was also the primary growth driver in Europe and in Africa for Diageo. So it is indeed true that Guinness is growing in many parts of the world.
All right, so I just wanted to tell you what the New York Times was saying about Americans drinking it 40 years ago. Quote, "It's impossible to classify the American Guinness drinker," said Thomas Cooper, Vice President for Marketing of the Guinness Harp Corporation in Long Island City, Queens. "Anyone might be expected to order a Guinness, though it is particularly popular with the Cuban community in Miami and with West Indians and Hispanics in New York. Guinness has been gaining in popularity on college campuses too. It has also developed almost a cult following on the West Coast," Guinness officials said. So the article goes on to say that people who knew what Guinness tasted like found the American version very disappointing because the pasteurization needed to make it exportable flattened the taste.
Yeah, well, that's been sorted out a long time ago. So today, Guinness has been the fastest growing imported beer in the on-trade in the US.
Yeah, and I should also finally add that Guinness 00 is also flying off the shelves and represents 3% of all the Guinness sold worldwide.
Yeah, which is in line with the moderation trend that we talked about a couple of episodes ago.
Yes, so going back to quoting CEO Deborah Crew, she concluded by saying, quote, "Overall, Guinness stands out as one of the few consistently strong performances across multiple regions in what is otherwise a challenging year for drinks."
And I think challenging year for drinks, particularly alcoholic drinks, is absolutely right. So building on that, in 2024, it was indeed a challenging year for most drink categories. So if we look at the data from IWSR, globally, we're looking at volume consumed, beer was down just under 1%, spirits down just 0.5% and wine down nearly 4%. So that's in 2024 versus the previous year, 2023. So if we drill down into stout, of course, which Guinness is the dominant brand in a market like the UK, they are forecasting at least an 8% future growth to 2028 for stout. And that's against the wider beer category, which is expected to fall by about 5% from 2024 to 2028.
Yeah, and listening, you know, the 5% and the 4% don't sound like that much in real terms, but actually that 4%, that 5% drop have been unbelievably significant. So 8% growth is huge. So it sounds like I need to know more than I do about what stout actually is, given that I know not very much. Okay, so you are the expert, having done your WSET level one in beer, so you're in charge of explaining it.
Okay, thank you, Felicity. So I thought I'd never get to show off my newfound knowledge.
Did you really?
Yes, so I feel very proud. So let's do a 101 on beer then. So beer is a fermented alcoholic drink typically used making malt. So that's the malted grains, water, yeast, and flavoured with hops. So I'm assuming at this point you don't want me to go into the milling, mashing, wort boiling, fermentation, carbonation.
Now, Lily, if I said, yes, I do, could you do it on the spot?
Yes.
Why don't you tell me what stout is in the context of beer?
Okay. So the different styles or types of beer are primarily achieved by the combination of these ingredients and the brewing techniques used. So we've got four ingredients in beer that I talked about earlier, one of which is water. So it's basically how the other three are used, which gives each beer its own characteristics and flavour. So according to the WSET classification, the key categories of beer are those that are either malt-led, yeast-led, hop-led, or in addition, there's also the category of sour-style beers. So in the malt-driven styles, it includes the most popular beer style in the world, that's in terms of volume, which is American or international pale lager.
So I'm going to introduce the only brand names I know. I guess you're talking about Heineken, Budweiser and Coors?
Correct, absolutely, Yeah. And they use what's known as base malts, which are lighter in flavour. So hence we get these lighter coloured and flavoured beers with the ones you were talking about earlier. At the other end of the scale in this malt-led category of beers, so where the malt component is really what's giving us the flavour, is stout. And that's where the malt is dark roasted, hence we get this dark colour and the flavours we have in Guinness. Now, as I'm saying this to you, I don't know where the word stout originated from. And I'm also not quite sure what the difference is between stout and porter, because we've both referred to both so far.
Okay, so I might be able to shed some light on this.
Thank you.
Porter was probably first brewed in London in the 1700s, and the style was named after literal porters, people who carried things around, particularly at Covent Garden. So these were workers that favoured the beer because it was, you know, it was almost like a meal and it had high alcohol content, which made it good going if you're on a long shift. So the word stout originally referred to something meaning strong or robust, and in the context of beer, it just meant a stronger version of porter. So stout porter meant a version of porter with a higher alcohol content and more intense flavours. Right. So by the late 18th century, it had become its own beer style. So it was known for those things that you were talking about, the rich roasted flavours, dark colour, higher alcohol content compared to, I guess, what were regular porters.
Okay. So thank you, Felicity. I can always rely on you for an informed history lesson. So now, while stout at this time was already, as you were just saying then, popular in London, I'm guessing, it wasn't a dominant beer style in Ireland, interestingly. So Ireland had a brewing tradition, and you talked about that earlier, but it was mainly focused on ale or lighter beers. But the rich roasted beer that we know today as stout was not the most common style until Guinness made it famous.
Yeah, so there's a question around how an Irish company like Guinness came to be making it. So as far as I can tell, and If somebody wants to write in and tell me a better story, I'm all ears. But as far as I can tell, it's because Irish brewers were struggling to compete against the English porter, which was a very popular style. So Guinness seems to have taken a if you can't beat them, join them approach. And by 1799, Arthur Guinness was just making porter and nothing else, and he abandoned ale making. So back to your niece's question, why is she drinking more Guinness, and why is it that so many people seem to have their own Guinness story at the moment?
As always, I don't think there's one simple answer, Felicity. It's always a complex web of factors, particularly when we're looking at brand growth or category growth. And it's that combination of them all together. So I think that really helps us understand what's driving the success of Guinness at the moment.
Okay, so let's have those factors.
Okay, so we could probably put them into three key areas: market context, product attributes, and marketing excellence.
All right, so we've already talked on the market context, mm-hmm. and we can see that the stout category is growing ahead of beer in general, and Guinness is obviously benefiting from this. So let's have a look at the second set of factors driving the growth of Guinness: product attributes. Can you explain what you mean by this?
I would be delighted. So product attributes, also known as intrinsic product cues. So this is the stuff that's inherent in the product itself. So if we changed any of these, we'd fundamentally change the product itself. So I would say a key part of the success of Guinness is that it's basically one product and one product only. Now, yes, before somebody also writes in and says there are a couple of variations in Guinness that are available in some African markets, fully aware of that. But primarily in most markets, it is one single product.
So you don't have the paradox of choice problem. You just go straight to the thing you want. And I guess the product itself always tastes the same. Okay, but why now? This has always been true of Guinness. So why now is this working so well?
Okay. Well, if it's okay with you, can I do a mini lesson on Guinness itself? Much of which I learned actually on my visit to the Guinness storehouse as prep for this podcast.
I think you must use this experience. And I'm so proud of you for actually going and visiting the Guinness brewery in Dublin for mm-hmm. no other reason than this podcast. Okay. Mm-hmm. So tell me about this must visit tourist attraction.
Well, it was incredible. And as you say, it's set in the original brewery building towards the sort of outer part of central Dublin. And it's enormous.
And it's still got 8,700 years to go on its lease. Did they tell you that?
Yes, exactly. So they can afford to invest in it. Right. So the experience as a tourist or a visitor actually was really amazing. So from the layout to the interactivity, the lighting to the wayfinding. And I wasn't sure if an attraction dedicated to one brand of stout would have enough to keep me or indeed others engaged. But how wrong was I?
Okay, so everybody in wine who's listening to this podcast is right now turning up the episode because they want wine tourism ideas. So you have to give details.
Yeah, so after about an hour and a half of making our way through the kind of storehouse experience, you move up from the ground floor up to level six. And in level six was topped off by a fantastic choice of three restaurants. And they were kind of, you know, really beyond your typical tourist sort of overpriced food court. Well, actually, you know, we're talking of topping off. The experience was literally topped off on level seven with the Gravity Bar. So it's a bar that sort of sits atop of the original building, and it has 360 degree floor to ceiling glass all the way around it. So you can see right across Dublin and out to the hills, of course, with a pint of Guinness in hand.
And did the gift shop have little bottles of Guinness for your Christmas tree, Lily?
They did not have Christmas tree decorations, but I'm going to come on to some.
They overlooked that.
Yeah. Do you know what I was actually thinking about? Should this year's 2025 theme be Guinness? But we'll come back to that later anyway.
Okay, so was the place packed?
Yeah, so it was. I would say it was super busy, but didn't feel overcrowded. So if we put this in context, the Guinness storehouse had more than 1.5 million visitors from 165 countries in 2023. And that was up 32% year on year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's won the world's leading tourist attraction. That was in 2023 as well. And if I go back to my slightly weird obsession of stalking and observing other people who were there on a cold Saturday in January, there was a real mix of ages and genders. It seemed to me like it was pretty much fully booked, as we kind of had to go into these, you know, kind of queuing system lanes for the 15-minute entry times on your tickets. And I'd say that the typical age of the visitors was probably mid to late 30s. You can supplement your ticket with a Guinness Academy session. So basically, this is where you go into a sort of bar area and there are multiple stations with bar taps. clearly with Guinness on, and you get taught to pour your own pint. So in the group of 10 of us that went in together, there were three guys in our group who were probably in their 50s, and they were from Hamburg in Germany, and a couple from England, probably in their 40s. And what was really interesting, because of course I engaged the lady in conversation, doing my research, and she confessed to me that she really didn't like Guinness, but that she was having a fab time.
It must be a pretty good tourist attraction. So if somebody who doesn't even like Guinness was there spending €28 per ticket plus the extra €10 for the Academy pouring experience, it sounds like something I should definitely go and see.
Yeah, absolutely. Strong recommend from me. And it did highlight to me the product attributes. So looping back to the drivers of Guinness growth that we were discussing before I delved into my storehouse experience.
Now, before I forget, listeners, just remember, if you work with beverages, then a trip like this is tax deductible. Mm. Okay, sorry, Lily, I interrupted you. Oh, you were talking about product attributes.
I was indeed. But there's always good reasons for traveling, Felicity.
That's right.
But anyway, product attributes. So these include the creamy texture, which itself is a result of nitrogen. Mm. So Guinness is well known for its use of nitrogen in its beer. So while many beers are carbonated with carbon dioxide, Guinness uses a combination of both nitrogen and carbon dioxide. This blend is especially prominent in Guinness Draft, which is poured using a special nitrogenated tap system. So nitrogen creates a smoother, creamier texture. And you know, those sort of small, well, you don't know because you haven't drunk it, those smaller bubbles compared to the sharp fizz that you typically get from a beer with CO2, with carbon dioxide. So whilst Guinness has popularised the sort of nitrogenated stout style, it's not the only one that uses nitrogen to achieve the signature creamy texture.
Do you know, when I finally get around to trying it, I'm going to pay a lot of attention to that. I'm going to
you
think,
are.
That nitrogen's really working. So yeah. I guess that's how you get the famous creamy top on the pint of Guinness.
Yeah, exactly. And another key product attribute that I think is really driving the success of Guinness is the fact that it's becoming more understood that actually it's lighter than perhaps traditionally perceived. So Guinness is sort of shedding its reputation as the sort of meal in a glass. So if we think about it, it's actually 4.2% ABV. So, you know, that's about the same strength, for example, as Bud Light.
So there's a couple of things there. One is, as you're talking about the carbonation, you've actually reminded me of a conversation I had with Brian Roth from Sightlines. He's a well-known beer analyst. And he said that carbonation is becoming a trend with particularly younger people actually looking for different amounts of carbonation, which I thought was pretty funny at the time to become a carbonation connoisseur. but also what you're talking about fits into the overall moderation trend of alcohol, moderating alcohol, as it's not that higher in alcohol. And then, of course, you know, the recent launch of Guinness 0.0 also fits into that.
Yeah, yeah. And if we're on the topic of product attributes, I think what's driven the success of 0.0 actually is its product attributes. Mm. The fact that it literally tastes and looks, well, kind of just like Guinness. So can I tell you another story here, please?
I love your stories, Luli. Please go ahead.
Thank you for your permission. So as I said earlier, everyone I speak to seems to have their own Guinness story. So I had a meeting actually earlier this week with Ian Harris. So he was the CEO of the WSET and has had a really long and illustrious career in the drinks industry. And he was telling me two things about Guinness 0.0. So he was at a rugby union match at Twickenham, which is our national stadium for rugby union.
And was it sponsored by Guinness? Was the logo everywhere?
Yeah, 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 because they do sponsor Guinness. We'll come on to that when we talk about marketing. But yes, they do. So he was at the match and he said that at halftime, at the interval, when everybody's rushing to the bar, they had run out of Guinness 0.0.
Oh, no. Yes. Oh, no.
I know. It's got to get that supply chain sorted, haven't you? So his second story was that at his local golf club, Guinness 0.0 has now become the most popular drink at the bar.
Now, there's a student research study there waiting to happen about, you know, can you track the quality of the golfing and how it changed when the 0.0 was introduced? Like, are people better or worse golfers since they started drinking non-alcoholic beer?
I don't know. I didn't ask him that, actually.
I think that's the obvious question, Lily.
I know. I missed that one, didn't I? I've got a third story. Can I do another one on rugby related?
Look, I'm so glad to hear that Ian is using his retirement well. Of course you can tell the story.
Okay, so final one. He was at another rugby match with his daughter and she went to the bar and got 2 points, one of Guinness and one of Guinness 0.0. So inevitably, because they looked the same, talking about product attributes, when she got back, she couldn't remember which was which. So they said, oh, that's fine, we'll try them and then we'll work out whose is whose. And he said to me, they both tried them, you know, next to each other, straight after each other, and neither of them could tell which was the full strength Guinness and which was the 0.0.
Just seriously, that is one of the great advantages that beer now has to the other alcohol categories. Mm. So with wine, if you want to de-alcoholise them, you have to remove the alcohol mechanically and it does a lot of damage to the wine. But with beer, you can actually use yeast strains that only ferment simple sugars, which means that pretty much no alcohol is produced, but you still get the same product. So it's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. Or they can leave the yeast out altogether and use enzymes. Mm. Yeah. So you get the kind of, you create a fermented product with all the flavors, but without the alcohol. So it means they can keep the taste consistent. And it's not just the taste that Guinness keeps consistent. So did you know Diageo have a 51-page document on how you're meant to serve Guinness?
Oh, do they? Okay, so I think that's taking micromanaging to a whole new level. So I've written many how-to documents in my life. And can I just say, when you check in later, nobody ever uses them. So I bet that manual is not exactly well-thumbed.
Yeah, but I think what I hear from bar owners, restaurant owners, etc., is that the salesperson from Diageo, from Guinness, is really kind of driving home the importance of the perfect Guinness serve. So they kind of classify it under these 7 C's, which include things like correct gas, correct temperature, clean lines, and clean glassware.
Oh, glassware. Now, that reminds me of something that I was going to bring up. Did you know that it's glassware that's driving some of the popularity of Guinness with younger drinkers?
I do, Felicity, so tell us more.
Oh, well, what's the point if you already know the story?
I'll give a bit about it. You go.
Okay, so you know the Guinness logo is basically the word Guinness, and mm-hmm. it's printed underneath the Irish harp.
Correct.
Okay. So when you pour the Guinness into a Guinness glass, you get the dark liquid that rises all the way past the harp, and then you get this sort of creamy, frothy foam.
Formerly known as the beer head.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay. So you get this layering of dark liquid, logo, and white head. And what it's done is it's offered this brilliant opportunity for a social media challenge, and it's called splitting the G, and everyone's doing it. Ed Sheeran has done it. So what you do is you fill the glass to the top, then you take a swig and hope that you've drunk enough of it that the remaining Guinness is now level with the middle of the G in the logo.
Indeed. So where, Felicity, did you learn about this?
Well, I spend too much time on social media. And also there's an ongoing argument about whether you should aim to get the Guinness level with the middle of the G or whether you should get it above the name Guinness but below the harp.
Yeah, so both Ella and Holly talked about splitting the G, but I'm not sure when it started.
Well, actually, a bit of a while ago. So it started about 2017 and then it spread from Ireland to London and then it took off in the US about 2 years ago. And it's gotten so popular that there's an app that lets you know if you split the G correctly if you're drinking from an unbranded glass.
Okay, so that's not the only social media trend. There's a fantastic account on Instagram. I don't know whether I now follow it very enthusiastically, called Shit Guinness London.
Okay, so what this is telling me, Luli, is we have got to put this podcast on YouTube sooner rather than later so we can put all these social media things in it. But until we do that, you have to describe it. So please tell me about Shit Guinness London.
Okay, so it was started by Ian Ryan, who's originally from Cork, and he's made a name for his account over the past few years by sharing and then getting his followers also to share basically the worst, most badly poured pints of Guinness in London. So he's got more than 248,000 followers on Instagram. And you know, when I started...
Do you think we all have too much time on our hands?
You could say that. When I started following it, okay, I noticed that two of my godsons also follow it because it came up on my Instagram. So clearly it's a thing because they're following it as well. So it's basically just these really badly poured pints. So, you know, whether pint is like half of the pint is the creamy head, or there's no creamy head, or it's in a non-branded Guinness glass.
Well, that just completely wrecks the whole point behind splitting the G. You can't do it if it's not being poured correctly.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder if Diageo talk about that internally. So they, I can see from the account that they certainly take notice of it. So where Ian Ryan's posting something, they'll often comment, but in a positive way, basically saying, you know, kind of thanks for calling out a shitly poured pint of Guinness. We'll go and visit with that pub. So I guess from a marketing and comms point of view, it's a really good example of how a brand can turn what could be a negative into a positive.
Well, we don't actually know how positive they are. We don't know if a guy in a dark suit from Diageo doesn't turn up at the pub brandishing that 51-page document saying, you didn't read it, did you? And giving them a quiz. Okay, so let's do a recap. So we've discussed that Guinness is growing. It's the star brand in the Diageo portfolio. The stout market, led by Guinness, is projected to grow and grow significantly ahead of the beer category. We talked about the fact that the product attributes of Guinness are supporting the brand, including the fact that there's only one Guinness. And of course, there's 0.0 and there's a focus, an incredible focus on the consistency of the serve.
Yeah, yeah. But just jumping in on that, I think what's fascinating is the, and crucial actually in driving the success of Guinness, is that they haven't moved to other line extensions. And okay, I think so that's a really important bit.
Identify what a line extension is.
Okay. So line extension is basically where you introduce a new product within the same category, but it's a variant. So it's a twist. So think Coca-Cola, Diet Coke, think Smirnoff Lime Twist, for example. So that's a line extension. So with the exception of 0.0, which is, one could argue, a line extension, and the slight variations that I mentioned previously in some African markets, Guinness really haven't messed with or changed from that one core product. So whilst there's the sort of theory of extensions, line extensions, product extensions, as they're sometimes called, Guinness have done lots of brand extensions. So this is where the brand is used in different categories. So by that, I witnessed this firsthand at the rather extensive gift shop at the Storehouse, which included an extensive jewellery collection of bracelets and necklaces, all featuring the Guinness Harp logo, Guinness Caramel Fudge, and even Guinness Onion Marmalade.
But apparently no Guinness Christmas decoration, which I think is a hole in the market waiting to be filled.
Yeah, well, I could advise them on that.
Yeah, I think you should. Yeah. Okay, so continuing the story so far, what I've learned, apart from the fact that all of your friends and business contacts have a Guinness story, is that they do really, really good marketing. Okay, so what about the other drivers of Guinness's growth that you mentioned? You talked about marketing excellence. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think that the success of Guinness has been impacted significantly by the marketing work behind the brand. So one of my marketing heroes, Mark Ritson, has highlighted this in a couple of articles that he's written within the last couple of years for Marketing Week. And he calls it a fundamental marketing done brilliantly.
Mark Ritson, is he the guy that runs the mini MBA in marketing program?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, indeed he does. So I actually took the course last year. Now, yeah, I should probably shouldn't
admit
this.
Are you getting kickbacks on all this, Lulu?
No, I'm not.
Honestly,
no,
is that what we're doing, all of this?
No, I paid for the course and I did it genuinely.
Yeah, sure.
No, I did. Because, well, as I suppose I shouldn't really admit this, but I'm kind of supposed to know about marketing. It's been my life and my business and my profession for a very long time. But I did the course and it's kind of online over around 10 weeks, if I remember. And I learned stuff, you know, I really did. So I would put it out there as an absolute strong recommend for anybody working in drinks. Even if your job isn't directly linked to marketing, it's still really useful to do. So did you know, fun fact, that despite Mark being my fellow Brit, he actually lives in Australia, Felicity,
no,
in your homeland.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So without trying to sort of push the boundaries of friendship too far and claiming that Mark Ritson's my bestie, which would be inappropriate, I did actually have lunch with him last year in Sydney when I was there on a stiflingly hot day, and we did drink beer, although it wasn't Guinness on that occasion.
Okay, so why do both you and Mark Ritson think that Guinness has been led with marketing excellence?
Yeah, so first up is the consistency of the key brand assets, KBAs, or what we sometimes refer to as distinctive brand assets.
Oh, I think you've mentioned DBAs previously. So if I remember, these are the visual cues that we associate with a specific brand, like the golden arches of McDonald's or the Nike swoosh.
Yeah, exactly. So what Guinness has done is maintained its focus on these distinctive visual elements. So in the case of Guinness, actually, we have a number of DBAs or a number of distinctive brand assets. So the first one is the name itself.
Well, if I was going to be cynical, I would argue they've had 350 years to get you to remember it. I mean, that is a first mover advantage and a half.
Yeah, you're right. But it's also easy and amazing how easy it is, I should say, for historic brands to die. So what has Guinness have done so well is the simple and memorable name in the visual distinctiveness. So we've got the typography of the name combined with the harp logo, which have kind of remained pretty much unchanged for hundreds of years. This has also been reinforced. We were talking about glassware earlier when you were talking about spitting the G. And it's been really enforced in the on-trade, in the on-premise zone, pubs and bars being provided with specific Guinness glassware. So back to that 51-page document on how to serve Guinness.
That's well-read by every
publican in the world, which has been... So the glassware with the logos on has been a really key way in which the brand awareness has been maintained and has been built. And then we also have the distinctive brand asset, which you were referring to earlier as well, as the product itself. So that kind of iconic black topped off with the cream, which today, as we would say, is sort of manifested as an Instagrammable moment. So I'm just going to do something. Felicity, have you noticed my clothing for recording this podcast today?
Oh. You're wearing black and white.
You haven't said anything. I was really disappointed. So for the benefit of our audio listeners, I'm wearing a black jumper with a white collar. So I'm like a pint of Guinness.
You are like a pint of Guinness. Why aren't you wearing the jewellery that I presume you bought at the gift shop? Where's your harp logo on your chest?
I didn't actually buy the heart necklace, but I did buy some Guinness socks.
Oh, God. I was going to ask you what other pieces of marketing excellence they were doing, but I think they just convert people when they go through that place. They come out the other end wearing black and white, clearly.
I'm sorry, I took us off track there. I'm sorry, you carry on marketing excellence. So, yes, I let me pick up. Sorry, I will bring myself back. So, yes, other parts of marketing excellence, like in rosé, we were talking about in our previous rosé episode, celebrity endorsement. So Kim Kardashian, Olivia Rodrigo have all been seen with Guinness, which has really helped popularise it, particularly amongst younger people.
I should have asked you, you're so enthusiastic. You didn't get a tattoo while you were there, did you? You haven't got Guinness stamped on your ass or something now. I mean, don't show me if you have, but I just want to know.
I'm not even going to respond to that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's go back to being serious. So I was thinking, while you're talking, do you think the popularity of Irish figures like author Sally Rooney have had anything to do with this? So what I was thinking is when I was a teenager, and I'm giving my age away here, there was a whole wave of Australian pop stars and comedians like Paul Hogan who became very popular in the States, and that had a huge impact on tourism and the sales of Australian goods. So something like that happening in Ireland?
Yeah, that ambassador of Australian culture, Paul Hogan. I'm glad you raised him there.
He was very good looking in his day, Lily.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if you look at broader data about sort of cultural trends, you can certainly see in more recent years a sort of cultural renaissance or increase in the impact of Irish culture in other markets and other places.
Yeah, and I think we shouldn't forget that although Guinness has recently become hugely popular, obviously, the popularity didn't come out of nowhere. Guinness was already in the pub waiting for a new generation to find it because the brand stands on about a century of some of the greatest advertising campaigns in history. I don't know if you remember, there was one in the 90s called Pure Genius, and it always starred the actor Rutger Hauer, and he'd always been doing something completely bonkers, like he'd be pretending to be an alien or he'd be a scarecrow in a field, and then then suddenly, for no reason, he'd just sit down and drink some Guinness.
Yeah. And they also used to run very famous print campaigns. So where the kind of creamy head would be turned into something like a bed or a bunch of balloons.
Yeah, that was a very iconic campaign.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So at the risk of both completely boring you and our listeners about my now infamous trip to the Guinness storehouse, they have a whole section there which is actually dedicated to the history of Guinness advertising.
All right.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to go around. So what struck me when I was looking at it is the Guinness advertising has really evolved quite dramatically over the years. So going back, its sort of earlier incumbency was around health-orientated messaging. Then we moved to the sort of animal-themed ads, including the sort of famous sea lion, and then taglines for, you know, Guinness for strength in the 50s to more sophisticated, as you, well, you were talking about Paul Hogan there, so more sophisticated sort of strap lines on my goodness, my Guinness, and Guinness, the pint that's worth waiting for. So really looking at the sort of almost like a sort of museum of Guinness advertising, which I got to do, it really sort of reinforced the fact that Guinness has always been quite cutting edge in terms of creativity and its communication. And what also struck me was that none of the advertising is really focused about around the product attributes specifically. So they don't talk about what it tastes like. Instead, they've always focused on sort of the emotional connection and more broadly the product benefits.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of that advertising is actually on YouTube, and I think everyone should go and look up the Pure Genius ads because they are wild. But anyway, okay, so getting more serious, do you think COVID had any sort of impact?
Yeah, well, I was going to bring that up, actually. So Diageo kept spending money on marketing during the pandemic. So they didn't cut back and they focused on winning the first pint when bars reopened. So I don't know whether you've ever seen it. If not, look up on YouTube again. There was a truly fantastic ad that ran in the UK as the pubs were reopening post-lockdown. And it featured just really simple images, for example, like a black rubbish bin with white rubbish falling out the top of it.
Okay.
Or black socks on a washing line with a white band at the top of the... So playing on the, like my outfit, the black and white sort of divided. And it was really interesting because it looked like these were sort of real images of streetscapes, almost shot kind of on an iPhone. And it had the soundtrack of You Were Always On My Mind. Okay. Really great piece of advertising.
So I have heard a very cynical explanation for the renaissance of Guinness, which is that people are sick of craft beer and that they're going back to full flavours.
Well, that it could be true, yeah. But in that case, the way Guinness has sort of focused on this still waiting for them in the pub, I think is really important. And it's maintained its presence at being top of mind, even during the lockdown. It reminds me that it builds on the now very well-regarded, more recent marketing principle that brand awareness rather than kind of brand love is really the only thing that matters when it comes to brand growth.
Yeah, and you know, it takes a huge amount of discipline to keep marketing during downtimes because, of course, most companies make the mistake of cutting back on advertising and marketing if there's a disruption or a downturn, when all of the evidence says that what you should do is you should do more of marketing and grab more market share.
Yeah, exactly. But that comes with a problem of its own, which is being too successful.
Oh, too much money, too heavy to carry? What's the problem?
No, the supply ran out.
Oh, Guinness right. Oh, right. Oh, my gosh.
Out in December in the UK.
Oh my goodness, what a disaster.
Yeah, so there was actually rationing. Now, one could say, if to coin your phrase, being cynical, you know, was there really a shortage of Guinness?
Of Guinness? That's a good question. Okay, so if something runs out, that's always a big opportunity for somebody else to leap in. Mm. So did anybody leap in with a new supply of stout?
Yep. So Heineken saw its Murphy's Irish Stout jump in sales. Drinks Retailing Magazine reported that they're going to start introducing multi-packs of both 4 and 10 in their retail channels.
So I wonder if that means we'll soon see an explosion of craft stouts.
Yeah, well, I think we're already beginning to see that because some of smaller Irish stout brands are, you know, for example, I'm seeing more and a broader stout category available here in the UK.
All right. So is there anything else that we haven't covered to explain the rise of Guinness?
Yeah. So I'd like to go back to that point about the sort of modern day perception and the fact that Guinness is actually lighter than people often think at 4.2% ABV, you know, fewer calories than other beers.
Mm. Okay. So big question to finish. Do you think they'll be able to maintain their market position?
Well, they are very disciplined. They're great marketeers. They've got a great brand and they're tapping into the better for you trend, both actually with the full strength and with the 0.0. Plus, you can play games on social media.
That's right. You can play games on social media.
And let's not forget that I think this is really important. In addition to that sort of long-standing advertising, we've also had long-standing sponsorship from Guinness of both the men's and, to me, very importantly now, women's international rugby union. And actually, Diageo recently announced a 4-year deal just at the end of last year, a sponsorship deal for the Football Premier League. So moving into, you know, from rugby into football as well. I think what's fascinating about the sponsorship is the official beer and non-alcoholic beer through sponsorship of the Premier League is that that's all about building brand awareness around the world. So can I do one final tangent?
You must do it.
Okay. Thank you. What I think is the Guinness brand team have done really well here is to focus on what the great marketeers, who I'm a huge fan of, Les Burnett and Peter Field, highlight, is that brand success comes from investing in both short-term but long-term advertising and comms, sponsorship would be included in that. So what they've done is they've analysed thousands of adverts from around the world and then the sales volume, rate of sales of the products that are being advertised, the brands that are being advertised. And what their work shows is that about 60% of brand advertising is on this long-term brand awareness and about 40% is dedicated more to kind of sales activation messages, buy me now. And what they've empirically demonstrated is that brands that focus at least 60% of their budget on this long-term brand awareness are the brands that grow best. Mm. And I would say that's one of the things that Guinness have consistently done. So it also then, I now tangent myself to tangent again, reminds me of Conciatura. So with their wine brand, Casiera del Diablo, so they sponsored in football as well, soccer for our American friends, football, Manchester United. But really the key driver, or why did Casiera del Diablo, a Chilean wine brand, sponsor an English football team? That was really about getting awareness raising in Asian markets where the Premier League is super popular.
Okay, so the future, what do you think the future holds?
So if I had to predict, I'd say we'll continue to see growth in Guinness. The market trends indicate that from a stout perspective, and Guinness is uniquely positioned for that. My daughter did raise an interesting point because, of course, she has a Guinness story like everybody else. She said that her observations were that Guinness was definitely becoming more gender agnostic.
Yeah, that seems to be happening across a few drinks categories. So that's like rosé wine, which we talked about on our previous episode, where about a third of men who drink wine are drinking rosé as part of their mix. That's in the UK and Australia.
Yeah, that's correct. But she was wondering, once the sort of splitting the G is yesterday's thing, will the awareness levels start to drop? So that kind of leads to the question, what's next from Guinness? You know, how are they as a brand and brand custodians going to keep that momentum going for Guinness above other brands that are now beginning to ramp up their advertising and their communications. That's other stout brands, which effectively means that you're reducing the proportional share of voice that Guinness have. So having been hugely popular for a time, more likely become the sort of classic standby potentially that's available in every pub and bar.
Look, I think the answer for the next 20 years is very clear. They just have to regularly lock Sally Rooney in a room until she produces another novel. But in the meantime, I think we've solved another big question: why Guinness is so popular.
Now, you've had your podcast homework. I hope you're feeling suitably inspired, and we look forward to hearing your review on Guinness.
Well, it might be a while coming because, of course, I live in a German town that's full of beloved beer brands. I think what I'll have to do is come and have one with you when we next catch up in London, because I guess by then you'll have done level two beer.
I am thinking about it. I'm definitely thinking about it.
All right. So to end, can you summarise what other drinks producers should learn from Guinness?
I can try. So simplicity and focus of brand. So thinking carefully before introducing line extensions. Yes, they can be great, but also they can just end up cannibalizing your existing sales. So you don't actually get increased overall sales, with the downside of significantly increasing your operational costs. So overall, your margins and profit can actually go down.
So we must not spin off this podcast, Luli.
Okay. I'm hearing you.
What else?
Be rigorous and uncompromising with your distinctive brand assets. Nurture them, love them, and think very, very, very hard before you change them. I would also say focus all comms in the first instance on long-term brand building, and then rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. The evidence is showing that consumers don't get bored of ads as quickly as marketeers and brand owners think
damn
they
right.
do.
They should bring back Rutger Hauer and his pure genius.
I know.
Rutger Hauer, because he's not here any longer, but they should get somebody else to come and do those pure genius ads.
Exactly. So typically it's the brand teams, marketeers, that cracks first and wants to change stuff in advertising or packaging or whatever it is, because they get bored of it because it's their day job and they have to look at it every day. But us as consumers, you know, we may see 5 ads a year from a brand or even 10. I'd also say encourage engagement and interaction. So that's like the splitting the G, and stand out that way, and also react to what is going on, typically through the world of social media channels, in a friendly way. So summing up, be really, really focused and disciplined about marketing. Don't stop working on marketing also, and investing even in a downturn. So
right.
There you go.
And on that note, I think we have solved another drinks question.
Thank you, Felicity. So don't forget, if you have a question you would like us to discuss, please send it to aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com, and we'll do our best to answer it. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche, the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.